Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231. It's October 22nd. We're going to start central nervous system today, though we got to go back and pick up just a couple concepts in the introductory chapter on the nervous system. And you see I'm hooking up my recorder. I lost my recorder. That's why I didn't put any lectures on the internet over the weekend. And I looked everywhere, my desk at home, my desk here at work, classrooms, the car, the driveway, and it was the last place I looked, which was my gym bag. So I have my recorder. I'll get these lectures online pretty soon. I guess I should go to the gym more often. I would have found it sooner. So let's look at the schedule real quick. Today's the 22nd. Yeah, I'm going to start central nervous system. We have some lab practicums starting November 5th. That's a Monday, and then on the 7th for your Wednesday group. And then we don't have a lecture test again until November 14th, and that's after a holiday. And the holiday's on a Monday, November 12th, Veterans Day. So we'll have our lecture exam on Wednesday, the 14th. So I think the next two lecture exams will be on a Wednesday, along with labs. There's no lab practicum scheduled for November 14th. But the very last day of class, December 12th, we have exam 4 plus a lab practicum on that day. And I know the Monday's group already had a practicum and a lecture test on the same day, so we're just kind of spreading that around a little bit. So don't get surprised by having this last week of the semester. You're going to have finals in every class that you're taking. If you have a final in that class, and probably a practicum too if it's a lab class, in all your classes. That's just the way it goes. Any questions on the schedule at all? None so far? Okay, well, let's finish up the chapter that we were working on. That was the introductory chapter. Oh, wait. Here's the sign-in sheet. So the sign-in sheet is going around. All your lab practicums have been graded. They're in Blackboard. All your grades are in Blackboard except for a quiz if you took it today in lab. But I'll get those up there real soon. If you want to find out where you stand in the class, be sure to see me during office hours on either Tuesday or Thursday, and I can calculate exactly where you are and what you need to do from here on out in order to get a particular grade. Okay, so we were looking at the introduction to the nervous system, and I said you should probably just memorize this flow diagram that I have on the very first page of your notes. It just breaks the nervous system down into its very useful and real components by the anatomy as well as the physiology. Remember, we can break the nervous system down into central and peripheral. We can break peripheral down into sensory or motor. Sensory just means signals are going to go from the periphery into the central nervous system. And if it's a motor pathway, it means that a nerve impulse is going to start in the CNS and then move out to the periphery to control some kind of effector organ. And we have two different kinds of effector organs. We've got somatic versus autonomic. Somatic just means that it's under voluntary control. And the only thing under voluntary control are your skeletal muscles. You can control it with your mind. Everything else is under autonomic control, automatically controlled. And the things that are automatically controlled are smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. All right, these are what we call the effector organs. Furthermore, the autonomic nervous system can be broken down into two main divisions, the sympathetic and parasympathetic. And the relationship between these two will be antagonistic. And remember, that's really a beautiful thing because this provides for precise control and balance of these effector organs. Just like in your automobile, there are antagonistic mechanisms to make sure you have precise control and balance of your car. And you would never think of driving your car without these two things, which is the gas pedal and the brake, right? And if you only had the gas pedal, you might be able to make it home. But if you did make it home, you just have to wave goodbye because you could never stop. Right, so antagonism is a very important thing. We're going to see in the nervous system. You saw it in the musculoskeletal system already. We talked about different kinds of neurons, what they look like and what their job function was. We talked about different kinds of neuroglia, what they look like and what their job is. We talked about the synapse, which is the structural and functional unit of communication between cells, and the most usual one is a chemical synapse. So there's a chemical signal that moves from the presynaptic cell to the postsynaptic cell, and you should probably be able to tell me what's the general name of that signaling compound that the presynaptic cell releases and then binds to the postsynaptic cell to start another electrical impulse. What's the name of that chemical. It's got a general name and a specific name. The general name is neurotransmitter, because it's being secreted by a neuron and it's transmitting a signal across the synapse. And then you should probably be aware of a couple special names of neurotransmitters. We talked about one, and I see it over here, ACH, capital A, capital C, lowercase h. That stands for acetylcholine. Acetylcholine is one example of a neurotransmitter. And acetylcholine is a neurotransmitter that's used at all neuromuscular junctions, which is how skeletal muscle is controlled, and in various other places inside the body. Anybody know of another kind of, a name of another kind of neurotransmitter? Probably. Maybe you haven't worked with it specifically, but maybe you've heard of serotonin, or norepinephrine, or dopamine. Okay, those are all specific examples of neurotransmitters that are released by neurons to communicate with other cells. Okay, I think that takes us down to some of these nervous system terms. And that is, let's just go through this list right here. Gray matter is a group or cluster of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, because this part of a neuron is never myelinated. If it's myelinated, it kind of looks white. But if it's not myelinated, it just looks like a typical kind of cell, and it's going to look gray. So gray matter is just nerve cell bodies and dendrites. That's the receiving part of a neuron. The CNS cortex is made of gray matter. So right on the cortex of the central nervous system, especially the brain, is going to be gray, because that's where we find nerve cell bodies and dendrites of cells. So the cortex is gray matter on the surface of the brain. A nucleus is sort of like the cortex, because it's gray, and it's going to be a group of nerve cell bodies, but if it's a nucleus, it's deep inside the brain. We're going to see some darker structures inside the brain, and that's what we call a nucleus. So there's a lot of different ways that we could think of a nucleus. A nucleus could be like the internal part of an atom that contains protons and neutrons. We didn't talk about that in this class, but if you take a chemistry class or physiology, you'll want to know that. A nucleus could also be part of a cell that contains genetic information, right? But here's another definition for nucleus. It's a group of neurons someplace, but just one part of a neuron, and that it would be the nerve cell body and dendrites inside the central nervous system. You might have a similar grouping of cell parts, nerve cell bodies and dendrites, but not in the central nervous system, in the peripheral nervous system. It's going to have the same kind of function, but since it's in the peripheral nervous system, we call it a ganglia instead of a nucleus. A nucleus is inside the CNS, and a ganglion is going to be in the peripheral nervous someplace. Okay, so if nerve cell bodies and dendrites are gray-colored, there are parts of neurons that are white-colored because they're myelinated. And you should be able to tell me what part of a neuron is myelinated. It would be the axons, right? And so white matter is a group of axons that are going someplace, carrying messages long distances within the nervous system, right? And so these axons are covered with myelinated sheaths. Furthermore, you should probably be able to say that this myelin sheath could be made by one of two kinds of cells, depending on what the location is. One kind of cell is a Schwann cell, and another kind of cell is an oligodendrocyte. All right, so there are two different kinds of cells found in two different locations in the body. Where do we find oligodendrocytes? Central nervous system. Where do we find Schwann cells? Peripheral nervous system. Okay. All right, so white matter is just a whole bundle of axons moving someplace underneath myelin sheaths, and that white matter could have a couple different names depending on what the location is. And guess what the two locations are? Central nervous system versus peripheral nervous system. If it's in the central nervous system, then it's a pathway taking signals through that white matter. We call it a tract. So a tract is something we see in the central nervous system only. But if it's in the peripheral nervous system, then we just call it a nerve. Right, the structure is going to be a little bit different. Slide on the right, I have a nice picture of a nerve, okay, and not a tract. But a nerve tract and a nerve are pretty similar in that they're myelinated axons carrying information in one direction. A tract is in the CNS and a nerve is in the peripheral nervous system. Okay, well, we talked about different kinds of conduction last time too. continuous versus saltatory. Saltatory conduction is fast. When it's on a myelinated nerve fiber, it could be as fast as 300 miles an hour. But if it's continuous conduction on a non-myelinated nerve fiber, then it's about 2 miles per hour. All right, so there's a huge difference. All right, so this kind of pulls us all back together to what the heck does a nerve look like? We see it over here at the slide on the right, and it might remind you of a muscle, like the biceps, because a nerve is separated into various little components, which we call fascicles, just like the components or bundles of muscle fibers are broken down into fascicles. All right, so here is a nerve in cross-section, and it's kind of a three-dimensional picture, so we get a little three-dimensional view. And since this is a nerve, what part of the central nervous system is this found in? Is this CNS or PNS? It's the peripheral nervous system. And you've pounded these things, unfortunately. There's a nerve that goes through your elbow called the ulnar nerve, and if you hit it just right, you feel some electricity or some specific pain associated with it, right? But you can see that it's an axon, actually a whole bundle of axons and a bundle of a bundle of a bundle of axons that are myelinated, okay, that are taking nerve impulses someplace in your body. And these are all wrapped together. So surrounding the whole nerve is the epineurium. And the building block of a nerve will be these fascicles right here, or you could say nerve bundles. The connective tissue that surrounds every fascicle is the perineurium. And there's even a connective tissue sheath around every particular nerve fiber that's in a fascicle, and we call that the endoneurium. So epi means on top, endo means on the bottom. Okay, so that might help you remember these different layers of fascia around nerves. So that might remind you of a muscle. And just like a muscle has a blood supply, a nerve has blood supply as well. I see a vein, and I see a, here's the vein, and here's the artery that's bringing oxygen and nutrients to all of these bundles of nerve axons, including these Schwann cells. Right? Oh, that would have been a good question. What kind of cell is making this myelin sheath? And you would say a Schwann cell, because it's in the peripheral nervous system, because that's where we have a nerve located. Right, in the central nervous system, we're going to have groups of axons like this all bundled together, and they're going to look white, but they're not a nerve. We're going to call that a tract. Right, and the tracts don't have associated blood vessels with them. They have other kinds of structures. They don't have so much connective tissue around them, because the tracts that are inside your brain don't have to put up with muscles that are contracting right next to them or other kinds of things that's protected deep inside your brain. All right, so here is a nerve. We're going to do some dissections of nerves and look at them in lab fairly soon. Okay, what about the organization of the nervous system? I think we talked about that already. And I think it's good to review. All right, so here is a unipolar neuron. This is bringing information into the spinal cord. What part of the nervous system is the spinal cord? It's central nervous system. And this right here is a nerve that's going to be found in the peripheral nervous system. And I see a bundle of nerve fibers making up this nice spinal nerve. And this is a unipolar neuron. It brings information into the central nervous system, into the spinal cord. So this is what we call an afferent neuron, because it's sensory. It's bringing information in. And part of the job of the central nervous system is to make sense of all of this information. And we do that with an association neuron or an interneuron. And I see a nice interneuron right here. And I know that's an association or interneuron because I see it completely within the spinal cord. It's completely within the central nervous system. While the afferent nerve, part of it is in the CNS, part of it is in the PNS. But an interneuron or association is completely within the CNS. All right, so it makes up its mind what to do. Sends information out this nerve, leaving the central nervous system. And what kind of nerve takes information away from the central nervous system into the periphery? It's not going to be afferent. It's going to be an efferent fiber. And an efferent and motor are exactly the same terms. We use those terms interchangeably. Okay, and so this is just a nice multipolar neuron. This is just one cell. And remember, how does a signal move across a cell? From the dendrite over the cell body down the axon, not the reverse direction. So signals are only can only leave the central nervous system on this particular neuron right here. That's why we designate it an afferent or a motor neuron. All right. On this cross-section of the spinal cord, we see some darker areas. This is gray matter in the central nervous system. What did we call gray matter in the central nervous system? A nucleus. Okay, so here is the gray matter in the central nervous system. Here is white matter in the central nervous system. What do we call white matter in the central nervous system? That's a tract. These tracts are either ascending up toward the brain, bringing sensory information to the brain, or they're descending tracts, taking motor signals out to the periphery. It's going to be one or the other. Okay, and then over here, here's the cell body of this sensory neuron. Okay, and so there's going to be a group, there's going to be thousands of these nerve cell bodies in this structure right here, and it's going to form a little bulge. What would we like to call this bulge that contains thousands of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system? That's what we call a ganglion. Okay, so a ganglion is what we find in the peripheral nervous system. All right, so signals come in the afferent pathway, they leave the efferent pathway. Now we want to connect some of these things up together. Here we have some integument, and remember the integument helps you communicate with your environment. Okay, it could be a pleasurable stimulus or painful stimulus. In this particular case, what kind of stimulus do we have? Painful stimulus. Good, I'm glad to hear that. All right, so here I see a pin, and it's poked into this person's skin, and it is stimulating receptors in the skin. Pain receptors in particular, but if this was a hot needle, it would also stimulate temperature receptors in the skin. All right, so a reflex always starts with a stimulus of some kind, and that stimulus could be mechanical, could be temperature, could be light if it's to your eyes, could be chemical if it's something for your tongue, right? Or if it's your ears, the sound would be a stimulus. And in order for you to perceive that stimulus, then you need the second thing, which is a receptor. So I don't like the numbering on this list very much. As you can see on my list in the notes, how does a reflex always start? It always starts with a stimulus, right? And then a receptor picks it up and it sends these signals via the afferent neuron. Here's that ganglion in the periphery into the central nervous system. So that's a sensory or afferent neuron. Gives information to the interneuron. This is an integration center. This neuron makes sense of all the information that it's getting from many receptors all over the body, makes a decision on what to do, and sends that information out the motor neuron. What's another name for motor neuron? Efferent neuron, to an effector organ. And in this particular case, it's a nice skeletal muscle. And what's a skeletal muscle specialized to do? To contract, right? So it's acting like a little motor, hence we call this a motor neuron, right? And the effector then, okay, and you should label this one, produces what's number 7 on your list. Number 7 is, in your lecture notes, is a response. So this response loop right here, or reflex, always begins, number 1, with a stimulus, and it always ends with a response. So we got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So I sort of don't like the diagram in your book, but that's okay because you'll like my diagram better too in about 4 months or so when you get into a physiology class. So this is a nice response loop or reflex. Let's look at some pathways that information is, well, here's a good example. Okay, so here is, some of you might know the name of this muscle right here. There's one lab that has studied this muscle so far, and it is the quadriceps femoris, part of the quadriceps in your anterior thigh. And we can stretch this muscle by tapping on the patellar ligament. You're familiar with the patellar ligament, and it's when we tap on the patellar ligament, it stretches the muscle. But the muscle says, you know, I really shouldn't be stretched at any particular time. That means I should be moving. And I really want to be stationary. So the length of my muscle shouldn't be changing. And all of a sudden something yanks it out of position. And there is a receptor, which is a stretch receptor inside this muscle. So the stimulus is stretch. The receptor is inside the muscle. And it sends that information in through an afferent neuron. Okay, in this particular case, that could be so damaging to your body, it doesn't synapse on an interneuron, it synapses directly on a motor neuron, an efferent neuron, which goes out this other route back down to the effector organ, which is the quadriceps muscle that was being stretched. And when this nerve impulse gets down to the quadriceps, or the effector organ, right, because it was being stretched, what's its response going to be to that stretching? The response is going to counteract that stimulus, which will be to contract the muscle to protect the joints that are in your body. So we call this a stretch reflex, a monosynaptic stretch reflex. So remember, the first thing is a stimulus. So maybe jot down in your notes, stimulus right here. And this arrow represents what? The arrow represents the response. Don't forget about those two really important parts of a reflex. Okay, here's a little bit more complicated one, but not too much more complicated. I think this is an exam figure. All right, so in this particular case, we do see an interneuron, association neuron, completely contained within the central nervous system. All right, and since it's a reflex, it always starts with a, oh, it's not labeled on this slide. Shame, shame, shame. So let's label it. This is a TAC, which is a stimulus, and you can perceive that stimulus if you have a sensor for it. So the stimulus is picked up by a sensor. The sensor then sends information down this afferent neuron past this ganglia, because there's the nerve cell body of this unipolar neuron, into the central nervous system. That information is passed on to an interneuron and makes a decision on what to do. And it says, gee whiz, that stimulus I don't like, let's get away from it. So it sends an information to this biceps right here, causing it to contract, and that moves your body away from that painful stimulus or damaging stimulus. Attack is not just painful, it could be damaging to your body as well. All right, so you got a stimulus, a sensor, an afferent neuron, interneuron, a motor or efferent neuron going to an effector organ in this particular case, for instance, the biceps. And what does the effector organ produce? You could draw like a little arrow right here, produces a response, right? So that's a whole reflex arc right there. Here are some neuronal circuits. Okay, diverging circuit. Let me just look at my notes right here. Yeah, okay, so a diverging circuit where we have one neuron and I see a number of bifurcations, or this axon splits into different pathways, so that information is shared between different neurons. And this is a pretty important pathway. Like, for instance, maybe this is a neuron in your eyes. Okay, and you might see kind of a bright object, and that bright object kind of looks like a pizza. All right, so your eyes are going to share that information. Maybe it's going to go to the occipital lobe, and it's going to say, well, there's an object right here, and it's a pizza, so, oh, that's really good to eat. So that's going to trigger some part of your body to maybe go over and have a slice of pizza. All right, and then when you look further, okay, you might see that, oh, it's got anchovies on it that goes to another part of the brain. Oh, now you don't like the pizza so much, right? So that information is being shared in different parts of your brain for different kinds of purposes. This would be a diverging circuit. There can be converging circuits where you have a single neuron, but it's receiving information from three different neurons. Maybe one of these is a visual neuron, maybe one is a smelling neuron, and maybe one is an auditory or hearing neuron. So let's kind of look at this. Why is it important to get information from various parts of your body? Well, I think maybe last week or week before we did the great shakeout, right, where there was like just a simulated disaster taking place on campus. And let's maybe consider that a disaster was taking place. Maybe there's a fire. Maybe you heard a fire alarm. Okay, so this neuron number 3 is sending information into the brain saying you hear a fire alarm. What would be a good thing to do? What would be a good decision for this neuron to make? If you hear a fire alarm, maybe exit the building, for instance, would be a good thing for this neuron to tell your body to do. Okay, but what happens, okay, if this neuron right here, which is coming from your nose, doesn't smell any smoke. You hear the fire alarm, but you don't see any smoke. Now it's a decision this neuron's going to do. Well, it's not so excited. It's going to say, well, let's look around and see what everybody else is going to do. Should we pack up all of our books? Okay, and then here's a visual neuron. So you look around the room and you don't see any fire, you don't see any fire, you don't smell any fire, you just hear the fire alarm. All right, so this neuron is going to integrate all that information up and make a decision on what to do. But what happens if you hear the fire alarm and you smell smoke and you see flames? What's the decision this neuron is going to make? Well, it's going to want to run away, right? So this is what we call a converging circuit for adding information up so that you have a nice complete picture of what's going on in your world. The last kind of circuit is a reverberating circuit, where there is one, come on, cursor, come back over here, where there's one input neuron, and it sends information to a second neuron, which sends it to a third, which sends it to a fourth, and it just so happens that this fourth neuron has a branch that eventually sends it back to maybe the first or second neuron, and it re-stimulates this circuit. All right, so all we have to do is stimulate the circuit one time, and it just kind of re-stimulates itself over and over and over again, because when the second impulse comes down, it goes back to this neuron, sends another impulse down, which goes back, which then sends another one down. So this is what we call reverberating circuit. This is an important kind of circuit that means a wakeful state of consciousness. It keeps you awake during the day. So as soon as you hear your alarm clock ring in the morning, this reverberating circuit is activated, and you're able to stay awake the whole rest of the day. And this is, and we're going to see where that part of the brain is. Yeah, mostly, right? Except an anatomy lecture, but I don't see anybody sleeping in here. That's good. Okay. So this is in a part of the brain called the reticular activating system. And if the circuit is malfunctioning, somebody might wake up, but what's going to happen to them? They're going to fall asleep right away. And then maybe somebody will wake them up, and then what happens? You fall asleep right away. Does anybody know what that's called? It's a medical condition that's really dangerous because you shouldn't have a driver's license. Narcolepsy, yeah, because you'd be driving down the 405 freeway and then all of a sudden fall asleep and, you know, you just might not wake up, and I might not wake up either if you run into me, right? So that's a really dangerous circumstance. And here's an example of damage to the reticular activating system. Okay, here's a little sheep running around. There are some sheep that spontaneously fall asleep. I didn't watch this video, so hopefully this is the one I wanted to show you. And let's turn it up maybe a little bit. Okay, cute little guy here. So these are the sleeping sheep. When they hear a loud noise, okay, they just go into this narcoleptic state. They just fall asleep. And it's not really dangerous for them unless they were driving on the 405. All right, so this is due to what? These reverberating circuits malfunctioning, okay, in the reticular activating system of the brain. Okay, so you can Google this. You can Google this sometime. All right, so where were we? Disorders of the nervous system. Okay, that's good. All right, narcolepsy is a disorder of the nervous system. Multiple sclerosis is another disorder. That's where the myelin sheaths of axons are destroyed or have plaques formed over them so they don't conduct electricity or nerve impulses correctly. Okay, so I think we're done with this chapter right here. All right, so we're going to go and start to look at central nervous system right now. Central nervous system. Yes, central nervous system. All right, what are the two main areas of the central nervous system? Brain and spinal cord, indeed. So let me pull that slide up, and I can sort of see the brain up over here, and then I can see the spinal cord right at the level of the foramen magnum that central nervous system turns in from brain to spinal cord, indeed. But let's look at the brain first. Okay, five general areas. We got brainstem is one, and we're going to look at some areas. Diencephalon is another, cerebrum is one, and cerebellum, and then spinal cord. So we're going to look at the central nervous system in these pieces right here. And I want to look at, can I see all of the brain in one slide someplace? Someplace pretty close. Let me get it going. That's pretty good. Okay, so here we see the brain. And maybe this is the first time you've looked at a brain, so it looks kind of funny. And the brain, the central nervous system, might be the most challenging chapter in the textbook because you're just not used to looking at people's brains hanging out in space. It's always, you know, through nice integument and skull and kind of stuff. But you got to be familiar with some parts of the brain. Okay, if we make a cross-section of the brain, we cut into the brain. Come on, cursor. If we cut into the brain, we can see that there's gray matter right on the surface of the brain. And remember, the superficial part of any organ is what we call the cortex. All right, so here's the cortex, and the cortex is what kind of matter? Gray matter, because it's made of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. And then these nerve cell bodies send axons down deeper into the brain, and they become myelinated axons, and that's what we call white matter. But they're traveling someplace. So this is an area that's going to contain tracts. White matter contains tracts, gray matter contains nerve cell bodies and dendrites. When we look at the surface of the brain right here, does it look flat and smooth? It does not. It looks all wrinkled up. Those wrinkles have a name. These are what we call convolutions. Right? If something has a lot of twists and turns into it, we say it's convoluted. So we see a lot of convolutions on the surface of the brain. There's a deep part, right? Like a valley. That's what we call a sulcus. And the high part is what we call a gyrus. And so here I have a gyrus followed by a depression that we call a sulcus, which is followed by a gyrus, which is a high part, which followed by a sulcus, which is the low part, followed by a gyrus. So we have all these different folds in the brain. And what this does is that it increases the surface area of the brain, because that's what gives us intelligence. The number of nerve cell bodies and dendrites that interact with each other gives us intelligence. So we could take a big tabletop like this thing right here and put a cranium around it, and that would be a pretty big surface area. It looks like maybe about 4 feet tall by maybe 2.5 feet wide. That would be a pretty smart brain, but then your head would be really weird shaped. So what evolution has figured out how to do is to crinkle this tabletop up and to fold it into a small spot inside the head that we have. And that's why these convolutions are here. Right, just to give us a lot of surface area for all of these nerve cell bodies and dendrites. All right, so what else do we see on this diagram? We see the spinal cord down over here. All right, and so the foramen magnum would be about in this region right here. Just above the spinal cord is the brain stem. Let's get this out of the way over here. Okay. And the brain stem is made out of the medulla oblongata and pons. These first two little bumps right here, medulla and the pons. All right, some other parts of the brain, I would just talk generally about it a little bit. Here's the cerebellum, which is just on the other side of the pons. And then above the cerebellum is the cerebrum with all these big wrinkles on it, or convolutions. And you can see that the cerebrum has a number of different lobes associated with it. Like the one underneath the frontal bone is called the frontal lobe. The one under the temporal bone is called the temporal lobe. The one underneath the occipital bone is the occipital lobe. And then here, underneath the parietal bone, is the parietal lobe. So that you don't really have to memorize too much. All right, so the cerebrum has these major lobes, frontal, parietal, occipital, and temporal. Most of these other parts of the brain don't have these associated lobes. Only this largest part of the brain, which is what we call the cerebrum, has these lobes. All right, so let's go back to the brain stem, which is made of the medulla and the pons right here. So maybe I'll put this, get this out of the way. Oop, get that out of the way. Oop, doesn't want to stay. All right, so what should we know about the medulla and the pons? Here are some important functions. It has a cardioregulatory center. It adjusts your heart rate. Is that a pretty important function, do you think? Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay, because right after lecture, you're going to stand up, your blood pressure is going to fall, and you would pass out, hit your head on the table, and then bounce off the chair, and then it would bounce off the floor, and it'd be really, I hate it when that happens. Okay, but as your blood pressure falls, this part of the brain knows it's falling, and it increases your heart rate so that you don't pass out. Fantastic thing. There's also a vasomotor center in the medulla oblongata that helps regulate blood pressure. And then there's a respiratory center, which helps regulate breathing for when you need to hyperventilate or maybe you could hold your breath, as well as some of these minor centers as well, right? But these first three are very important centers that keep you alive: the cardioregulatory center, vasomotor center, and the respiratory center. Swallowing, vomiting, coughing, sneezing, these are also some other things that take place in the brainstem, in particular the medulla oblongata. Okay, sometime, maybe today, I'm going to show you these longitudinal ridges on either side of the medulla, but I don't think I want to take time to find them right now. Okay, I want to talk about some other things, but I'll talk about them in a little bit. The pons. Here I see the pons. It contains partially some functional areas that help in regulating your heart rate and breathing. So it works with the medulla, especially the respiratory centers, but it's a relay station for sending signals from the spinal cord that have to go into the cerebellum. So what the heck does a relay station mean? Maybe I want to tell somebody in the back of the room, but I don't want everybody to know, right? Because all I could do is yell at somebody up there. But another way of doing it is I could just write a note, right, stick it in an envelope, and I could give it to somebody in the front row, and they could turn around, pass it to somebody in the second row. They could turn around and pass that note to somebody in the third row all the way back. That would be a relay. Okay, so it's just a part of a passageway for sending information from one part of the brain to another. That's an important function of the pons, for signals that have to go into the cerebellum. The way they get into the cerebellum is through the pons. So signals come up the spinal cord, through the medulla, into the pons, and then into the cerebellum. That's the most important function. Okay, the midbrain. Midbrain is just above the pons. It has the corpora quadrigemina. Now I guess I'm going to have to find a nice picture to show these things. Here's a pretty good picture. All right, so here is the spinal cord. So foramen magnum would be about here. Here is the medulla. Here's the pons. Here's the cerebellum. So the pons can send signals into the cerebellum. And then just superior to the pons, right in this region right here, is another part that we call the midbrain. And the midbrain has these two little bumps. Can you see bumps yet? Have you developed an eye maybe to see these things? These are pretty small, but there's two little bumps right here. There's two on the right and two on the left. So if there's two on the right, two on the left, there's four altogether. That's why we call that the quadrigemina. Corpora just means body. Corpora quadrigemina just means the four little bodies right in the midbrain. And these have some interesting kinds of functions. All right, let's move this out of the way. Oh, I can't do that. All right, let's do that. So the superior colliculus, one of these is called a colliculus. So here's the superior colliculus, here's the inferior colliculus. You have two superior colliculi. These are important for tracking visual information. Right, it allows your eyes to look at an object, fix on that object, and then figure out where it's going. All right, so I know some outfielders, right, like Andre Ethier, can track balls as they're curving and spinning around in space, and it's this part of his brain right here that can tell, right, by watching a baseball for a really short period of time, how fast it's going up in the air, how fast it's dropping, if it has spin, if it's curving, and where he has to run to catch it in a certain period of time. Okay, that's for visual tracking. All right, your conscious thought is up in this part of the brain. So your ability of your eyes to track information are way down below in the midbrain, and it has nothing to do with perception. So somebody's eyes can track an object, and they might not have any idea of what they're looking at. All right, that's sort of interesting. Maybe I can talk about a further example of that. All right, the inferior colliculus over here is for localizing sound. It allows you to tell where sound is coming from. So if there's damage to this area, you wouldn't be able to tell where sound is coming from. We could do a quick experiment, but I don't want to take time. I could have all of you close your eyes, okay, and you trust me because I'm a doctor. And I could sneak around the room. I could open and close a door. I could open and close that one. I could open and close that one. I could open and close that one over there. Or open and close that one. And with your eyes closed, by using that inferior colliculus, you could tell what door was opening and closing. Just because this will compare, the inferior colliculus will compare the time of when a signal reaches your right ear and compare it to your left. So if it reaches the right ear first compared to the left, what does your brain know? It's over on the right. Okay, so it does that in a really speedy fashion. So this is part of the midbrain, the corpora quadrigemina. It's got these two parts, superior colliculus and inferior colliculus. And the other part is the cerebral peduncle, which is right here. Cerebral peduncle is kind of a funny name, a peduncle. And what it is a bridge from one part of the brain to another. It's a major bridge. And it's a bridge that takes signals from the brain stem up to the cerebrum, and hence its name, cerebral peduncle. So peduncle is just a bridge. And you get to look at them in lab. Here is the bridge between the pons and the cerebellum. Remember, we said that the job of the pons was to send signals into the cerebellum. And there's a bridge there as well. And that's called the cerebellar peduncle, which carries information into the cerebellum. It's not labeled on this particular slide. But here's the cerebellar peduncle, bringing information into the cerebellum. Here's that bridge taking information into the cerebrum. So here's the cerebral peduncle. Okay, and then this whole area right here contains those reverberating circuits, so including the pons and the medulla, which make up the reticular activating system or reticular formation. This is what keeps you awake. So if somebody gets a stroke in this area, or maybe a really bad infection or other kind of pathology, then they might suffer from narcolepsy, right, where they just fall asleep at any particular time if the reticular activating system is damaged. Right, so the RAS, or reticular activating system, is part of the brain stem. Okay, so that's the brain stem. So we're moving superiorly in the brain. So we got spinal cord, brain stem, including the medulla, the pons, cerebral peduncle, the corpora quadrigemina, and then above it, we get to another part of the brain called the diencephalon, which is in this region right here. The diencephalon has got a couple main parts. It's got the thalamus, which is in the very center. The thalamus acts like a relay station, just like the pons. Right? The pons is a relay station for signals entering the cerebellum, but the thalamus is a relay station that takes signals from the spinal cord and sends it to the proper part of the cerebrum. So before sensory information can get to the cerebrum for your appreciation and understanding, it has to pass through the thalamus first. So this is the region of the thalamus. Then down below the thalamus is the, you could probably tell me, because you know the dermis, and what's below the dermis? The hypodermis. So here is the hypothalamus. And the hypothalamus is really important. It's a master control center of the body. It controls temperature, hunger, and thirst, as well as many aspects of the endocrine system. So it controls the pituitary gland, which would be about in this region right here. It's not shown on this particular section of the brain, but the pituitary is going to be right here. Maybe you remember the sphenoid bone had a fossa depression called the sella turcica. And so that's where the pituitary is located, right in the very center of the sphenoid bone. All right, so here's the diencephalon with the thalamus and the hypothalamus. All right, the cerebrum. We talked about that already. And I see some lobes. What's this lobe right over here? Occipital lobe. And what would this one be? Parietal. And over here would be the frontal lobe. And I can see a little bit of it peeking out on the side. This is the temporal lobe. And remember, the surface of the brain is not flat and smooth. It has all these wrinkles, actually deep wrinkles in it, that we call convolutions. The high point is a gyrus, and this low point right here is a sulcus. And they just follow each other. All right, let's talk about some of the functions. The frontal lobe. The frontal lobe is an important area for a couple things, but one is for initiating motor activity, initiating skeletal muscles to contract, and when skeletal muscles contract, your skeleton moves around. So that's an important motor function. All right, so skeletal muscle, and in particular where that's located. Oh, that's a really good picture. Where that's particularly located. Okay, here is a sulcus, right here. And it goes all the way from the mid-sagittal part of the brain all the way down to the temporal lobe. This is what we call the central sulcus. Everything in front of the central sulcus is the frontal lobe, and behind it is the parietal lobe. So the central sulcus separates the parietal from the frontal lobe. And just anterior to the central sulcus is this high part. What do we call a high part again? A gyrus. And we name it after the central sulcus. So this is the precentral gyrus. This is the part of the brain that's responsible for initiating all motor activity in your body. All right, so if there's a damage or stroke to this part of the brain, then you'll lose control or motion in that part of your body as a result. So we call this the primary motor cortex in the frontal lobe. And that's kind of easy to remember, because where do you have the motor in your car? At least most of you do. Is it in the front or is it in the back? Most of you have your motor in the front of your car. Some of you might have it in the back, okay? But most of you have it in the front, so think of frontal lobe as the motor cortex for your body. Does anybody have your motor right smack in the middle of your car? Anybody have a motor right in the middle? Nobody has one right in the middle? Ah, that's too bad, because I would like to drive it sometime. But anyway, so the frontal cortex is for motor activity. Okay, but also, this area that is in front of the motor cortex, this is for cognition. This gives you reasoning and rationale. It gives you the sense of how to behave properly in a social circumstance. Okay, and when this part of the brain is damaged, then people lose their sense of how to be appropriate. They can be inappropriate. They can be loud and boisterous, or they might elect to be drinking all the time, okay, if there's damage to this part of the brain. We call this the prefrontal cortex. All right, then we got the parietal lobe over here. Here's that central sulcus once again. Here's the precentral gyrus, and right behind the central sulcus is the postcentral gyrus. It's not for motor, but this is your primary sensory cortex, especially on the surface of your body. So we call this the primary somatosensory cortex. This is where you feel like when somebody grabs your hand to shake your hand. Okay, this is where you feel them. Or somebody picks you with a pin on your skin. This is where you feel it. Okay, or something hot or cold. If I were to put an ice cube on your back, this is the part of the brain that would allow you to experience that painful experience, or the cold experience, or the hot experience relative to some spot on your body. All right, so this is the primary sensory cortex in the postcentral gyrus. The precentral gyrus is for motor activity. All right, so that's why we say the parietal lobe is the primary sensory cortex for touch, pressure, pain, and temperature. And the areas are kind of aligned with each other. So, for instance, if you were going to move your arm with this part of the precentral cortex, this part over here would then allow you to feel sensation in your arm. It wouldn't take you to a different part of the body. So it would kind of match up, like nose to nose, motor versus sensory, elbow to elbow, motor versus sensory. And somebody's made a diagram of that correspondence, and it's called a homunculus. Let's see if I have a nice homunculus someplace. Uh-oh, I don't see it. Ah, here it is. All right, let's look at this diagram first. All right, so here's the central sulcus. Here is the motor center. That's the primary motor cortex. Here's the sensory center. This is the primary sensory cortex. And remember, when we say sensory, that is what? Afferent information. And when we say motor, that is efferent information. You can refer to those just the same way. Here's the central sulcus. And you can see that the postcentral gyrus is what color? I wanted to ask you, what color is this? Blue. And the precentral gyrus is red. So kind of remember that color coding, because we're going to make a cross-section through these two different gyri right here. Okay, so here is red. Where did we find red? In the frontal lobe, and we saw blue in the parietal lobe. And then if we were to stimulate these different areas, for instance, in the frontal lobe, if we were to electrically stimulate this part of the cortex, your tongue would move. If we were to electrically stimulate this part of the cortex, your lips would move. Or if we electrically stimulate this area, what part of your body would move? Your eyes would move, right? And then over here, your thumb and your hand. And of course, this takes a lot of brain power to work your hand because you have a lot of fine muscles for good discrimination of controlling all of your finger muscles and hand muscles. And then over here, your back doesn't require a lot of neurons because, well, we just don't really do much with our back. Okay? And then our feet require a certain amount of processing power, nerve cell bodies and dendrites right here. So notice your foot is way down over here, your hand is in this region, and your face, right, for facial expression has a lot of neurons. Right? So this is the precentral gyrus or the motor map. It kind of draws out a little person. Right, but then if we go to the parietal lobe, this is for sensation. So if we were to stimulate this part of the brain right here, then it would feel like somebody is maybe tickling your nose or something. Right? It wouldn't be like shaking your hand or tickling your foot. This would be specifically for the nose. That corresponds exactly to the nose region in the precentral gyrus. So there's a nice one-to-one correspondence with the face, the tongue, right, the hand, and the foot. So this little person right here is what we call a homunculus diagram. So I belabor this point a little bit, not that this is an exam figure, but just to point out that the precentral gyrus is for motor activity and the postcentral gyrus is for sensory appreciation for signals coming from the surface of your body. So if somebody has a stroke and there's a stroke in this part of the brain right here, it's the postcentral gyrus. Is it going to be a motor deficit or a sensory deficit? It's going to be a sensory deficit. And what kind of deficit is that going to be? Well, then they'll lose taste, right? Because it's coming from the tongue. But if it's over here, okay, they get a stroke in the precentral gyrus, what kind of deficit is that going to be? A motor deficit or a sensory deficit? A motor deficit. So this person can taste things just fine. They just can't swallow because they can't control their tongue. Okay, so that's why it's really important to know these different areas of the brain. Okay, occipital lobe. Oh, the temporal lobe. Let's go back to temporal lobe. So here's the temporal lobe right in this region. And about right in this region right here, this is the primary auditory cortex. This is the part of the cortex that's responsible for hearing. All right, so appreciating music and the verbal language. Right, so understanding language, okay, is in Wernicke's area, right about in this area right here. So sound information comes into the temporal lobe, the primary auditory cortex, and then the primary auditory cortex sends signals, if it thinks it's speech, to Wernicke's area right here. And Wernicke's area can order all of that sound information and can tell you, that maybe sounds like English, maybe sounds like German. Okay, maybe it sounds like Spanish. And then furthermore, if it's Spanish, it could tell you what letter it is and what word in this part of the brain. So if somebody has a stroke in this part of their brain, they might be able to speak properly. They just can't understand what other people are saying. So it's kind of strange. Broca's area is the motor part for speaking. It's in the frontal lobe, so here's Broca's area. If somebody has a stroke in this area, that prevents them from speaking because they can't form words. But if their Wernicke's area is just fine, they can understand exactly what everybody's saying, they just can't respond because they don't have any proper motor activity for speech. So that's pretty fascinating, different parts of the brain. So temporal lobe is the primary auditory cortex. The occipital lobe contains the primary visual cortex. So if we were to stimulate this part of the brain, somebody would have the perception of seeing something. It wouldn't probably make sense. Maybe it would just be some sparkling or something like that. But as we grow up and use our eyes, then this part of the cortex learns how to take visual information and make sense out of it. Like if we see certain black and white patterns, we know it's a written language. Or if we see other kinds of patterns of colors, then we can see that it's a painting, maybe a representation of a landscape or something. right, or a certain spatial arrangement, you're going to say, oh, that's my mom, just by stimulating this lobe right here. But the primary visual cortex receives information from the eyes, and then the primary visual cortex sends information to deeper and deeper parts of the occipital lobe for finer and finer visualization and discrimination of visual signals. Okay, so that is the brain stem, medulla pons, midbrain, the diencephalon, which we can't really see, and the cerebrum. And you can see the cerebrum is the biggest part of the brain. All right, so not only do we have sulci, but sometimes we have fissures inside the brain, some things that are much deeper than sulci. Okay, so here is a lateral sulcus that separates the parietal from the temporal lobe. There's a sulcus, right? But there is a longitudinal fissure that separates the cerebrum into right and left parts. Let's see if I can find it. Right and left parts of the cerebrum. Oh, here. Okay, so here I see the right hemisphere. Here's the left hemisphere. And there's a big separation between them that we call the longitudinal fissure. So this just means that there's a space between the right and left sides of the brain. And the right side of the brain performs some important thinking considerations, and the left side, other kinds of considerations. So how is it that your right side and your left side of the brain know what's going on? They have to share information electrically between each other. All right, and that's because there are things that we call commissural pathways. Let's look at this slide. So here's the surface of the brain going down through the longitudinal fissure. Okay, I can see a kind of a solid structure. So we're no longer on the surface of the brain. We're on something that looks like a C. That's called a corpus callosum. And this carries information from the right to the left hemisphere, or from the left hemisphere to the right. So we call that a commissural pathway. When information goes from right to left, that's a commissural pathway, and that's partly due to the corpus callosum. There's no way for signals to go from one side of the brain to the other through the fissure that's right over here, only through the corpus callosum, or the anterior commissure, and then there's also a posterior commissure right over here, which is not labeled on this slide. So a commissural pathway A commissural pathway interconnects corresponding gray areas between the right and left hemispheres. All right, so they're aligned in a transverse plane, so they're horizontally aligned. Some good specific examples of a commissural pathway will be the corpus callosum and the anterior commissure that we can see on this slide. All right, because here's superior, here's inferior. These pathways are going in and out of the plane of this image. But there are other ways that, oh, I tell you what, when we look at this corpus callosum right here, can you tell, does it look dark or does it look white? It looks white, right? It contains myelinated axons. So pathways are tracts within the central nervous system that are taking nerve impulses. Commissural pathways take them from right to left within the central nervous system. Okay, but there are other kinds of interconnections, which we call association fibers. Right, again, these are horizontally aligned. Right, they don't go from one hemisphere to another. They just stay on the same side of the brain, like between Broca's area and Wernicke's area. Association fibers between the speech, the motor speech area, and the sensory speech area. All right, let me see if I can find some examples of these kinds of pathways. Maybe.
Here's a good picture. So we have pretty much a mid-sagittal section through the brain. Here is the corpus callosum, and these little dots signify tracts that are moving from the right to the left hemisphere. So they're a nice transverse section, so all of these different tracts just look like little circles. Right, so these are commissural fibers going through the corpus callosum and anterior commissure, posterior commissure, so that the right and left hemispheres know what they're thinking. Okay, but the anterior parts of the brain should be able to communicate with the posterior parts of the brain, like in Broca's area going back to Wernicke's area, and without going to the opposite side of the brain. So here are some tracts. I got to get this cursor working. Here are some tracts that start anteriorly and then take information to the next gyrus that's posterior to it, or to even another gyrus posterior to it. These are what we call association fibers. So they can take information anterior to posterior, but not from right to left hemisphere in the brain. Because the tracts that take right to left information are the commissural pathways. Right, but information also has to travel another way, and that's from superior to inferior. Like from the thalamus. Thalamus takes information from the spinal cord and sends it to the proper cortex of the brain. Like, for instance, the thalamus will take visual information and send it to the visual cortex, or auditory information to the auditory cortex in the temporal lobe. These are what we call projection fibers. And it kind of looks like sun rays coming out of the sun right here. Sometimes we call this the corona radiata. So corona radiata has projection fibers that takes information from an inferior part of the brain to a superior part, or from a superior part to an inferior part, but not from anterior to posterior, and not from right to left, just up and down. Okay, some examples of a projection fiber that we're going to take a look at is the cortical spinal tract and the corona radiata that we can see right here. All right, cortical spinal tract. A tract, you know, is in the central nervous system. It's made up of white matter. And just like in muscles, like if, for instance, we're going to say coracobrachialis, the name of a muscle. That's really nice because in the name of the muscle, it tells you what the origin and insertion is. So coracobrachialis, what's the origin of the coracobrachialis? The coracoid process of the scapula, the insertion would be the humerus or brachium. Right, when you have a tract like this, cortical spinal tract, it tells you from where the signals are originating and where they go. The cortical spinal tract, the signals originate in the cortex, cerebral cortex, and where do they end up? In the spinal cord. So is that a motor pathway or a sensory pathway? Since it starts in the cortex and goes to the spinal cord and eventually will leave the central nervous system, that's a motor pathway. It's a descending tract because it starts high and it goes lower. That's a motor tract. If it was a spinal thalamic tract, that would be a sensory tract because it would start in the spinal cord and go up to the thalamus. Okay, so it's really handy to know different kinds of nomenclatures. All right, so that's good for the cerebrum. Let's look at the cerebellum. So here's the cerebellum, and I see white matter and gray matter. Gray matter, again, on the surface of the cerebellum has a lot of smaller convolutions. White matter tracts, myelinated axons carrying information, and all of these gray areas right here, the cerebellum is making sense of information, and the job of the cerebellum is to maintain postural control of your body so that you don't lose control of your body in terms of the musculoskeletal system. So it allows you to walk and dance and probably even write. Okay, this is the part of the brain that develops when you learn how to hold a pencil or play a flute, right, or even how to walk upstairs or downstairs without tripping. Okay, is the cerebellum. And it just programs and fine-tunes motor activity. Or if you're walking down the sidewalk and a friend is kind of horsing around and you don't see him come up to you and they hit you on the shoulder really hard, okay, and it might knock you over, but as you're about ready to fall, the cerebellum notices that your body is sort of out of control and it sends signals to other muscles in your body to catch yourself before you fall. That's the job of the cerebellum. Or maybe you tripped accidentally,
It's a cerebellum right here that's catching you, making your other leg move out in front of you before you trip and fall. So this is the cerebellum. This pattern of white matter and gray matter is what we call the arbor vitae. And arbor vitae, anybody know what arbor vitae means? Arbor is tree, vitae is life, tree of life. So if there's a nice healthy pattern that we see of gray matter and white matter, that usually means it's a nice healthy cerebellum, right? And so that's the tree of life that we see. So tracks versus gray matter in the darker matter. Okay, spinal cord. Let's look at the spinal cord a little bit. Maybe I'm going to go back to the very first picture we were looking at. And can you tell me, is spinal cord part of the central nervous system? Absolutely. Okay, so here's the spinal cord. And it begins right at foramen magnum. And it goes all the way down to the division of L2. Here's the second lumbar vertebrae, and it stops right here. Let's see if I can zoom into this without losing too much detail. Okay, here is the end of the spinal cord right at the division of L2. It doesn't go all the way down to the sacrum. There are nerves in the vertebral canal. Right after they leave the spinal cord and until they exit through the intervertebral foramina. Okay, so here is a pretty good picture of a spinal cord. And down below, or the very tip of the spinal cord, we see kind of looks like a cone that you'd put ice cream in right here. We call that the conus medullaris. That's the very tip of the spinal cord, the end of the spinal cord. And the reason why our spinal cord is not as long as our vertebral column is because nervous tissue can't grow as fast as the rest of our body during development. And it's still anchored down to the sacrum via this little connective tissue that we call the phylum terminale. All right, I'm going to scoot down here, take a look at that phylum terminale, if I can get the cursor. Yes. All right, so here's the phylum terminale. It puts a little traction on the conus medullaris. Otherwise, the conus medullaris would retract up to the brain and damage all of these spinal nerves coming out of the vertebral column. All right, every once in a while, the phylum terminale doesn't develop properly so that the conus medullaris adheres to the sacrum during development. And then somebody grows really tall and it stretches and damages the spinal cord out when that happens. And then the phylum terminale has to be reduced to allow for partial retraction of the spinal cord. Hopefully that's diagnosed really early before somebody has many developmental problems as a result of that. And that's called, anybody know what that's called? When somebody's conus medullaris is tethered to the sacrum here during development, that's called a tethered cord and produces severe neurological deficits within the spinal cord when that happens. All right, so within the vertebral canal, we see all of these nerves coming down from the conus medullaris, and that reminded somebody of a horse's tail. And so we call that the cauda equina. All right, so all of these nerves do leave the vertebral canal via the cauda equina to get to the sacral foramina in the sacra or the intervertebral foramina in these other lumbar vertebrae. All right, well, we're going to leave it there and start next time probably with this picture right here, which is another picture of the spinal cord. So the sign-in sheet is going around somewhere. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. I'll turn some lights on. And let's see. The recorder was working.